Howdy and welcome to Thin Air News with an Altitude from Small Town Public Radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Garasio. Howdy. This month, rafters and landowners clash in Crested Butte.
They'll go through your flower bed. They'll stand on the jetty and urinate.
We have a report from the Green Party convention in Denver.
Bush and Gore will take our money. Certainly this Ralph Nader will.
In Telluride, 4th of July included a Boston Tea Party.
T-shirts for sale over here. Please support the cause.
From Boulder, what if the drug cops are on drugs?
As far as marijuana, we see some historical usage.
But first, our monthly mosey around the Thin Air beat. In Pagosa Springs, Greens and developers are fighting over who has the support of candy heiress Jacqueline Badger Mars. The Sierra Club bragged that it had convinced Mars to pull out of the controversial Piano Creek Golf Resort in the East Fork Valley, but supporters of the project say Mars merely transferred her interest to her daughter and son-in-law. The Sierra Club's Mark Pearson countered that the developers threw the first stone by dropping the Mars name in Forbes magazine and the Wall Street Journal.
We reported recently that the resort town of Avon is banning mobile homes. Now Bayfield, east of Durango, has decided to clear out its city-owned trailer park. Owners say it's hard to sell their trailers because there's nowhere else in the area to put one. Bucking the trend, the town of Salida has approved a rare new mobile home park that will have 62 spaces.
The town of Leadville is debating whether to approve a Christian camp that would include a conference center, lodging, and camping facilities for 3,000 people. Most controversial is the Eagle Sky Foundation's plans for new water wells. Also in Leadville, vandals have been blocking the new 13-mile mineral belt trail by felling trees up to 40 feet tall. And Leadville's Meals on Wheels program is in danger of losing its funding due to lack of participation. One theory, baby boomers don't retire as early as previous generations. 125 years ago, the Four Corners Monument was created. At this desolate spot on Highway 160, four states converge. In the center of a patio-sized concrete slab, you can get down on all fours and say you are simultaneously in Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. There's even an ashtray on each corner of the patio so you can have a smoke in each state. Nearby is a dilapidated row of wafer-board shanties where you might see a handful of Ute Mountain Utes trying to sell souvenirs. Now Congress has appropriated $2 million to spiff up the site, including a new interpretive center, but the four states must each pitch in $500,000 more dollars. Arizona has agreed. In New Mexico, the legislature approved it, and the governor vetoed it.
An immediate moratorium on webcams at all national parks has been declared by Park Service Director Robert Stanton. The furor began over the Old Faithful webcam at Yellowstone, which features corporate ad banners. After getting complaints, Stanton ordered the Yellowstone Rangers to drop the solicitation of corporate sponsors. Stanton says the popular websites are virtual parks and should contain no ads. Later this summer, he will convene a panel of legal, technical, and policy experts to consider the future of national park webcams. In related news, the Olympic Organizing Committee has filed suit against 1,800 cyber squatters, websites that use the word Olympics in their domain names. At its annual meeting in Park City, the National Ski Areas Association tried once again to analyze the plummeting popularity of downhill skiing. No longer can ski areas rely on snowboarding to prop up sagging lift ticket sales. Association President Michael Berry said snowboarding was a band-aid solution, noting that the number of knuckle draggers grew by only 6% last year. Berry said ski areas have also failed to attract minorities. Baby boomers, the previous staple of the industry, are giving up cold weather vacations. Across the board, skiing is failing to generate return customers. Currently, only 4% of ski area visitors go on to become core skiers, skiers who get out at least several days a year. This month, the Rio Grande River south of Albuquerque is expected to officially dry up, meaning there will be no continuous stretches of water. This has happened before, but some ecologists say this dry-up could be the end for the Rio Grande silvery minnow. The problem was compounded when Albuquerque's number 2 treatment plant spilled raw sewage, enough to fill 30 residential swimming pools, into the Rio Grande. A planned release of 200 of the rare minnows was canceled because of the sewage spill.
In Congress, a post-Los Alamos debate continues over whether the western U.S. should be fireproofed by the thinning of trees. The Senate has passed the National Forest Health Initiative, which provides $240 million to thin forests around threatened towns like Boulder, Flagstaff, and Santa Fe. But experts say on a national scale that won't go very far because it costs about $1,000 an acre to thin forests in residential areas.
Another follow-up to the Cerro Grande fire, with most of the watershed denuded above Los Alamos, a rock dam is being built to guard against flash flooding. A new study has doubled the chance of such flooding, forcing the 50-foot dam to become a 70-foot dam. Also, some Santa Fe food shoppers and restaurant owners have been wondering if local produce got a dose of toxics from the Los Alamos fire. Organic farmers in northern New Mexico are voluntarily submitting their produce for testing. In the Aspen Valley, public hearings are beginning on whether to ask regional voters to pay an extra half-cent sales tax for public transit. The hearings follow 8 months of negotiations by the governments of Aspen, Basalt, Snowmass, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, and Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties.
The Association of State Green Parties held its national nominating convention in Denver in June. On hand was Denver's First Strike Theater, doing a Billionaires for Bush and Gore skit that reportedly made the hotel staff nervous.
Virtually unidentifiable from each other, now it's time to show the Greens the power of big money.
The Greens aren't for sale. What are you talking about?
Oh,
John Stroud at KDNK in Carbondale filed this report.
In addition to nominating longtime consumer advocate Ralph Nader to run for president, the Greens adopted a platform that addresses a number of issues. Mike Chamness, a longtime Green Party activist now living in Carbondale, Colorado.
Some of the major issues we're dealing with are economic justice issues, green tax policy issues, dealing with the concepts of switching the tax burden away from an income tax burden on individuals to a waste and environmental tax, which would tax waste and pollution.
And on a national level, the party has grown substantially since Nader's symbolic run in 1996, when he didn't actively campaign and was on only 11 state ballots, but helped bring credibility to the Greens as a third-party alternative. This year it's different. The party expects to be on 40 state ballots come fall, and with a high-profile candidate like Nader, who's running for real this time, the Greens expect to be a major force in bringing key issues to the campaign. Krista Paradise, who was the first Green Party member elected to public office in Colorado when she joined the Carbondale Town Council in 1996, explains what she believes Nader brings to the Green cause.
Of course, there's name recognition issue, and that's been really wonderful for us. But he's also a man who is considered to have an incredible amount of integrity.
While much of the focus now is on the national election, Paradise said that ultimately the goal is to increase Green voter registration on the local level.
We want people to realize that they might have the same values that we have, but they haven't heard of us yet. And so there might be a lot of people out there who are fundamentally Greens, but don't realize there's a party out here to represent them.
Once people know about the Green Party, local Greens hope to begin running Green candidates for local office. Chamness believes it's time to further the progressive movement in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Well, it's fairly obvious we've got a fairly large progressive element in the Valley, which another group we're affiliated with, Mountain Folks for Global Justice, has been quite successful with tapping into the last few months. So for us locally, I think it's all about cultivating and focusing that energy that's in the Valley that's already present with this phenomenal group of activists that are here. And number two, I think there's real room for Green candidates because there are a lot of unopposed races, but there's room for, I think, a progressive political party in the Roaring Fork Valley.
A change in state law in Colorado 2 years ago gave greater access to local ballots for alternative political parties. San Miguel County Commissioner Art Goodtimes was elected in 1996 as a Democrat, and this year he's running for re-election as a Green.
Well, I think there's been a huge disenfranchisement with the political process. We see that in the numbers of people who actually vote, and I think we also see it in sort of the dissatisfaction with even the people who vote. We hear a lot about the lesser of two evils. individuals from both parties. People aren't satisfied with the candidates that are eventually chosen. And when you only have two candidates and both of them seem to be speaking about relatively the same things, all of them in the middle, it doesn't really reflect the diversity of our population.
You think that same atmosphere has trickled down to the local level as well?
Locally, people tend to vote on personality more than parties. Nevertheless, I think we see a lack of diversity in when you only have two choices. I know our county sheriff has changed parties. He's no longer a Republican. He's a Libertarian. We need to have parties that reflect our real values.
For KDNK in Carbondale, this has been John Stroud reporting.
People who are not here as part of this organization do need to leave. If you wish to pick...
In our last two editions, Thin Air has reported on regional reaction to the war on drugs. This month, what happens if the cops, the soldiers of the drug war, are high themselves? May Jarrell reports from KGNU in Boulder.
The city of Denver will be hiring over 400 new police officers in the next 2 years. But Denver and other cities find applicants often have records of illegal drug use and arrests. The city's newly named police chief, Jerry Whitman, says it's not always easy to hire new police officers, despite the pay.
So we're talking, you know, mid-30s. So it's a pretty attractive job, great benefits. But then again, the job market, you know, in the metro area and all over the country is great, too. So we have difficulty recruiting. As far as marijuana, we see some historical usage. Some of it was generational. It's kind of decreased over the years from the, you know, the candidate that came on mid-70s. So it's not as prevalent an issue.
Of Denver's new police hires in the last 18 months, 52 of 80 recruits admitted to past illegal drug use, usually but not always merely marijuana. The FBI, the DEA, and city police departments in Dallas, Austin, Seattle, and other cities also allow past drug use, especially if it is only cannabis. In Denver, applicants must conform to a civil service requirement of no illegal drug use in the past year. The mayor has commissioned a panel to evaluate whether changes should be made in the Denver police eligibility requirements. Another panel looked at national drug laws, treatment, and prevention. Denver Mayor Wellington Webb.
Obviously, the judicial system is a big issue that needs to be addressed in terms of the inequity in sentencing, as well as the inequities on some laws that the Congress have passed in terms of, for example, the sentences for crack cocaine are higher than they are for what wealthy people, how they use cocaine in a powdered form. And so, I mean, there are a lot of inequities that we have to address.
Mayor Webb named new personnel in law enforcement and safety after a storm of protests over police brutality, no-knock raids, and public outrage over the hiring of new police with a history of law-breaking, including illegal drug violations. This is May Jarrell in Denver.
Over the 4th of July, it was more than just sun and fireworks heating up Telluride. A rally and highway march by hundreds of locals paralyzed traffic coming into the small resort. All hell had broken loose over a proposed new development. The marchers included Telluride's current and former mayor, a United City Council, and prominent civic leaders.
Is it appropriate for absentee corporate landowners to make decisions that inalterably fragment and disconnect us from this valley?
No! So we are, in fact, pitting ourselves as a community against very powerful forces.
If the valley floor is developed commercially, we'll lose that sense of place that makes it feel like our home.
This is the future of Telluride. If we allow development out there, you can say goodbye to everything we came here for.
For 3 miles, Telluride's legendary Valley Floor stretches from town to Society Turn. It is lush with wetlands fed by the headwaters of the San Miguel River. This is where the black and white spotted valley cows graze. This is where the hang glider pilots of the Telluride Air Force land. This is where thousands of bluegrass cars have been parked. This is also where the Iditarod mine had planned to put its next tailings pond. But the mine closed, and the valley floor was sold to Neil Blue, who owns General Atomics, the San Diego-based defense and nuclear contractor. Since the 70s, Blue has wanted to build a resort hotel, golf course, commercial complex, and man-made lakes. The project floundered as three local governments competed for control over the land. Blue brought the battle to a head by asking the upstart Mountain Village for annexation. He brought to a full boil a long-simmering movement among locals to acquire the valley floor outright.
We're being watched by a lot of people and a lot of communities that are struggling with exactly the same problem we are. Where to draw the line? I think we all know in our hearts where that line must be drawn.
If we spend this kind of money, no matter how many billions of dollars it is, it means by definition that we won't be able to do other things that would have perhaps made our lives richer in some different fashion.
Protecting and nurturing the landscape around us reaps benefits not only today for our generation, but for generations hundreds of years from now.
If we do not fight this battle, we will surely lose.
Right on.
Let's win our valley floor.
Mountain Village is only the latest government to be created around a brand new ski town, a tradition in Colorado that dates back to Vail in the 60s. Snowmass Village at Aspen was born in the ski and real estate development of the 70s. Mountain Village was a product of the 80s and 90s, fighting battles every step of the way on zoning, gondola transportation, destruction of wetlands, and finally creation of a brand new municipal government that coincides with the ski area boundary. Mountain Village even went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to gain second homeowners the right to vote in local elections. It is this government, still largely controlled by the ski company and associated developers, that the locals do not trust with the valley floor.
Ex-ski patroller Paul Sherry sits on the Mountain Village Council, which he says is slowly evolving into autonomy and has a responsibility to consider the valley floor.
I don't think we would really deal with it differently. And I think we're trying to really take it a regional approach. I really don't know if it's the best interest of the community to just let it sit there and be totally open space. I think we can get a lot of things for the community.
Sherry says Mountain Village has a sensible growth plan and knows how to get things done.
We're going to add another 200 parking places up here. Plus, we got the Village Court apartments. We're adding some more employee housing. I mean, we have an overall goal. We have something that was identified.
Do you feel comfortable that you are representing the average person actually living up here now?
Well, that's another, what is the average person that lives up here? I mean, we represent about the top 2% of the social economic bracket. And a lot of these people are not here, you know, in the so-called trophy homes. But, you know, I have no problem with sort of this community. I'm used to it. I lived in Vail. I've been in Santa Fe. And I look at these trophy homes, and I think for every one of these homes, there's four or five families like myself, raising kids, making a living.
So we're going to save the valley floor. We have t-shirts for sale over here. Please support the cause.
Meanwhile, the town of Telluride has hired attorneys to pursue condemnation of at least part of the valley floor. It promises once again to be a long, hard-fought battle.
When you say you love me, then prove it by going out.
You're listening to Thin Air.
Proving your love isn't true. Call me Mr. Blue. I'm Mr. Blue.
In Crested Butte, like many places in Headwaters country, there is a growing tide of resentment between river users and those who own the banks on each side. Gunnison County is holding hearings to work out the differences and avoid new legislation or a wave of lawsuits. Tony Todd reports from KBUT in Crested Butte.
Tom Kleinsnitz spoke for the Colorado River Outfitters Association, a group that represents 168 commercial river guide businesses statewide.
We're out there doing business. We want to do that respecting everyone around us, including other river runners, private landowners. We're up against a rock and a hard place. If there's no way to be able to float through property or float stretches of water openly, our business would end.
Don Erke is a private landowner who's had some bad experiences with river users. He says that the problem is not so much with the commercial outfitters, but with the growing number of individuals who choose to float the river without the benefit of a guide service.
My observation has been that the outfitters basically are more courteous. The ones that probably are the worst are those outside of that. The individuals are rude, trashy. They'll drag their equipment up on the lawn. They'll go through your flower bed. They'll stand on the jetty and urinate. And that's a thing that's happening that's making, I think, a lot of us that live along the river have some concern.
Joanne Stone has owned property along the Gunnison River for more than 40 years. She supports local outfitters and efforts to resolve conflicts between floaters and landowners.
We have not had any problems with commercial rafters. The other thing that I'd like to say is when we get high water, we have a lot of people that are going down in inner tubes. And at one period of time, we pulled 18 people off the river in 10 days. We worked with commercial rafters on that, and they've been really good to help with rescues. They're our first call when we get somebody in the river in trouble. And so I would really like to laud your efforts of trying to work this out. Once legislation gets a hold of it, you don't know where it's going to go.
Don Sabrowski from Wapiti Ranch is frustrated by his experiences as a property owner along the river.
We're trying to protect our property. There have been great liberties taken on it. There have been trash thrown in it. Lots of things have happened on it that just aren't right. The numbers scare us. The number of people floating down that river increasing all of the time.
Floaters are allowed a right of way along the surface of the water. Touching the bottom or shoreline on private property with a foot or an anchor is considered trespassing. While outfitters know this, the general public seems less aware, and that public gets larger every year. Matt Brown operates Scenic River Tours in Gunnison.
I would say it's doubled every year for the last 3 or 4 years.
Property owners and recreational river users agree that education could be the most useful tool. The Colorado Department of Natural Resources has produced a brochure, River Runners Etiquette and Responsibilities. The pamphlets will be widely distributed later this summer. Representatives from the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service agreed to post signs along problem stretches of river to inform floaters where public land ends and private property begins. Outfitters will continue what they've been doing for years, that is, to address those individuals they see on the river who act inappropriately. Mark Day is an experienced guide who feels that while outfitters can be a source of information for river users, they should avoid confrontation.
I see people trying to pull rainbows out of catch and release areas and put them in their basket, bank fishermen, and said, hey, do you know those rainbows have to go back to the water? I think we can say things like that, but as far as policing, at times I'm scared that that guy's head is going to snap and he's going to pull out a gun. So I think you have to be careful about how anyone but the police can...
It seems that private property owners and commercial guide businesses have begun to resolve the issues. It's the behavior of private boaters that is now a cause for concern. This summer's efforts to educate them and improve their overall river etiquette may impact the future freedom of all river users. For KBUT, I'm Tony Todd.
On the Four Corners Arts Beat, here's Connie Gotch from KSJE in Farmington with flautist James Pellerite, who has taught himself to play European music on Native American flutes.
You have to do some practicing.
A professional musician all his life, Pellerite played in the Philadelphia Orchestra and Detroit Symphony and taught at Indiana University. He retired to the Southwest, where he discovered the built-in beauty of the native flute. Beginning with the instrument's natural five-note scale, he's gradually discovered how to expand its capabilities and is accomplishing this without altering the instrument.
The beauty is already built in. So then, if you play the complete G minor scale, this involves variety of fingerings. I would like to think that it was another calling, yes. I was taken by the sound of the instrument, which led me to believe that there was more to it than simply the pentatonic scale. And the entire story is based on the fact that I do chromaticisms and the maximum use of tonalities that the instrument is capable of producing.
His G minor flute is about 22 inches long and fashioned out of pink ivory wood from Mozambique. To discover the instrument's full tonal range, Pellerite used orchestral literature.
The opening to the Firebird Suite, to me, is one of the most beautiful. So by extracting what the contrabasses are doing at the opening, I actually have a scale that enables me to practice many of the complicated fingerings. For instance, on the native flute then, the opening to the Firebird would sound like this.
The downsliding cry at the end of the passage blends the European and Native American flute playing techniques.
That is a tradition in the vocal approach in Native American music, and it has found its way into the flute.
Native Americans have always had mixed reactions to Pellerite's work. At first, Cherokee composer David Yeagley hesitated to accept the instrument's integration into European music. Later, he agreed to write a piece for Pellerite.
He listened to my CD. In addition, my pleading for this freedom to be able to express myself musically on the Native American flute. And he agreed that, yes, it would be a more than acceptable new direction.
Pellerite has played concerts on his native flutes across the United States and abroad. In Japan, he performed with a player of the traditional Japanese flute, the shakuhachi. Australian composer Graham Pounding has written him a piece that includes sounds of the Aboriginal flute. He has found a freedom playing the native flute that the Western flute doesn't offer.
To embrace a philosophy other than that of flute playing is very unusual for a classical musician. You spend your life normally learning the techniques of the modern instrument, and of course these are the traditions that you follow. But with the Native American flute, I had the spirituality of the instrument come to me first. And then I developed whatever technique I could, because there was no technique, and there still isn't.
Former Western classical flutist James Pellerite, he's adopted the Native American flute to Western sound, and he concertizes across the country. His CD, Echoes and Boundaries, includes traditional melodies and original compositions for the instrument.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition. You might be listening to KRZA in Alamosa and Taos, KAJX in Aspen, KGNU in Boulder, KDNK in Carbondale, or KBUT in Crested Butte and Gunnison.
Or you might be hearing us on KDUR Durango, KAFM Grand Junction, KZMU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KRCL in Salt Lake City, or KOTO Telluride.
Funding for Thin Air comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.